hey, how are you? Great to hear. Yeah, come in. Make yourself comfortable. Like a drink? Sure. There you go. Welcome to the Tech Lounge. Shall we begin?
Welcome to another Tech Lounge with me, Christian Scheller. I am still on the road, so you're getting not my usual setup for this intro, so I'm going to keep it brief, and I'm going to say this is an interview recorded earlier in the year with Corey from Crowdbotics, who are another company in this AI code reuse ecosystem space. But interestingly, and we kind of cover this early in the interview, they've actually been around for quite some time. So they're not one of the recent entrants jumping on the bandwagon. They've been doing this for a while. They, I assume, know what they're doing. It's an interesting interview, and the audio quality in the interview is much better than this intro. So I reckon we should just jump in. Enjoy.
Before we begin, there's just a few people at the door who've got some things they want to tell you. Then we can get stuck in. If you'd rather not hear these interruptions, then please support the show. You can find details in the episode and show notes. Today I'm joined by Corey from Crowdbotics. We can't see the video on this recording, but if you weren't sure of the company, it's currently blazoned right across your chest. Exactly. Tell me more. Let's just start a little bit with what Crowdbotics is and then take it from there.
Yeah, sounds great. And thanks for having me.
Of course.
And yes, I am emblazoned across the chest like a NASCAR sponsor here. But yeah, so Crowdbotics itself is a company that is obsessed with reuse. And specifically, we are really, really interested in how to do three things. Mm-hmm. One is, you know, how do you make code relevant to non-developers? Mm-hmm. The second is, how do you index, catalog, and enable code reuse kind of at scale? And then three, like, how do you do both of those as low impact to existing workflows and the way people do things today? And that's something that we've been working against for the past 6 years.
Oh, wow.
And with the advent of AI, it's really started to blossom as far as what we're capable of doing.
So tell me, 6 years is a reasonably long time in the lifespan of any tech company, to be honest with you. So what was the origin story? And before this 12 to 18 months of the current kind of LLM revolution, what were you doing before that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, so we got our start. There was this really fascinating paper out about using six years or so ago about using recurrent neural nets mm-hmm. to do character by character code generation. And we saw that as this kind of amazing future and being able to leverage the power of, you know, machine learning to generate code. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, at the time it wasn't, we tested it and it kind of worked, you know, to a degree, a lot less robustly as what LLMs that we know today can do. And so it wasn't that great, but we saw that there was this real need and kind of like interesting use case for being able to generate code. And we saw the time of said, okay, well, if we can't really generate it net new of this whole philosophy or idea being able to go to natural language mm-hmm. straight to code, that a lot of companies spend a ton of money and a lot of time to write code. So we said, all right, well, what if we can find a really novel way to kind of like index and catalog and reuse that? So find pieces of code that people have already written and then start to pair that with natural language in the form of either user stories or requirements, and then deploy that out and kind of give developers this non-zero starting point. Yeah. And that's what we've been kind of working against. So we've been kind of honing and building those tools over time. And then, you know, circa the Cambrian explosion of AI with, you know, Sam Altman and the GPT yeah. transformer and everything coming online, it really has boosted what we were, you know, this, it turned a very steep climb into a very fast climb and one that isn't quite as hard. So that's what we've been doing. And, you know, I've seen a lot of improvements in what the models are able to do, but they're still really not perfect for pure code generation from natural language. And
it's interesting because, you know, many would probably look at what you're doing and think, oh, you've just jumped on the bandwagon, but you actually were there before. Many of the people, you know, someone might say, well, why should I use this over XYZ? And it's because, well, firstly, you were actually there before them. Has the past 18 months kind of helped or made it harder? Because you now have more competition, but at least you probably don't have to keep explaining what you're doing all the time.
Yes. I mean, it's definitely made the story much easier, right? And really it has helped, honestly, a lot of like our third kind of goal pillar of making the whole thing seamless. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there now tackling the natural language, the code gen problem, and a lot of them doing it, I would argue, like effectively a lot better than we are. So we're really strong partners with GitHub, who has done some amazing work in what they've been able to do with their new workspace tool, as well as Copilot and their kind of, they call it like the ghost code that shows up. And we want to let them keep handling that problem. But what we've seen is that even with all of the code gen tools out there, a lot of them can actually improve, and we're doing some studies now to empirically prove that being able to, it's one of those where the better inputs that you put in, the better the code gen is. So now what we have kind of started to do, and where we've arguably have always been, is that idea of like what would like AI native software development look like, and how do you actually expand that beyond just the development side? So what does it mean for product managers and BAs? Yeah. What does it mean for the release cycles for QA? And how do you kind of build these ancillary tools that make the whole system work better? And so it's definitely, to your question, has definitely made the story much easier to tell and a lot more interest now than what it was before. But, you know, philosophically, where we're at on this idea of reusing and, you know, not to steal the recycling tagline here in the United States, but the reduce, reuse, recycle kind of mentality is still very, very important.
I'd like to come back to that in a moment, because you've mentioned those terms a few times, and then I look at some announcements you've made recently. But I just want to go, before we go too far into the present, I just want to go back 6 or 7 years. What made you found the company in the first place? What was the problem that you were trying to solve at the time, if you can remember?
Yeah, so I, right. Yeah, so I actually wasn't the founder. Okay. Yeah, but I have spoken with our CEO and founder a number of times on this to understand really what was the genesis of all of it. And it was that question around, what does the future of software development look like with AI? Like, where is it all headed? And now it has become very clear that I've seen it stated a number of times, you know, the future of programming is in natural language. You know, we saw that and he saw that a long time ago, but it was this concept of, and I hate to say like democratizing development because that's not really it, but it is this ability to improve on computer science fundamentally and what it means to solve problems using technology, which has historically always needed to be done in, you know, pure code that can be executed on a von Neumann machine. But in reality, where the world is headed is drastically different than that. And being able to use natural language really expands the pool of people that can get the most out of software. And that is really, really interesting to us. And I think that it's going to be extremely impactful on the world as a whole, but also, you know, what it means for computer science, what it means for programming, what it means for developers themselves. It's all shifting. It was the innovation happens slowly and then rapidly.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that kind of rapid climb right now.
Yeah. And I just wanted to understand, you talked about user stories and things like that a moment ago. So does CrowdBotics actually connect up with, I don't know, I have a Jira ticket saying list view of orders, and in theory, I could generate some some skeleton code from that, or have I just extrapolated a little bit too far?
No, I mean, you've got it right. And, you know, the way that our workflow and kind of systems work today is that you're able to go in, you can kind of give it a natural language, just so, and it can be a couple sentences to uploading paragraphs of what you're wanting to build. From there, we leverage machine learning and AI to generate a bunch of user stories and acceptance criteria and user personas. And then we actually index and match existing code to those, right? And some of those user stories might have 100% coverage from existing code that's out there. Some of it might be partially covered from it. And then we basically take all of that code that already exists that's been matched with what the product requirements have and dump it into a repo, and then the devs are able to kind of pick that up and move from there. So it's almost this kind of, you know, in like DevOps and, you know, and kind of release, there was a large push years ago to kind of build these like boilerplate kind of deployment scripts and infrastructure, but they were all static, right? So every dev, no matter the product or the project and the requirements that change, you always had this like this static code that you got. And what we're doing is making that, instead of static, it is now dynamic. So we're able to kind of put this scaffolding and put and precede these repos with initial code that is 100% relevant to that specific project, right? And that is a bit of a shift in what was out there. And it's really interesting to see the kind of efficiency gains that devs get, as well as what it means for, and we work a lot with enterprises. So it's being able to index private code that enterprises have invested with and then be able to match that with those requirements and see how businesses start to look at software development and look at investments to code differently, knowing that pieces and parts of it will be reused in the future. So you almost kind of redefine what code means from not only a development standpoint, but also from a revenue and budgeting standpoint, which is interesting.
Digging into, because you've mentioned these R's a few times, the recycle, reuse, et cetera, et cetera. But from the beginning, are these snippets coming from public sources and then gradually they build up into the more internal ones, and someone's like, oh, I need a loop to go through these things, and the platform suggests, well, this was already done in this application 2 years ago and it worked. Maybe don't just reinvent the wheel, this kind of thing, or?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that we're always working to redefine. So for us, we call them modules, but it's basically any reusable artifact, right? And that could be as simple as, you know, a few methods within a code class. It could be a full code class. It could be a front end and a back end that's been encapsulated and packaged up for reusability. And that is always this kind of wavering definition. You know, it's at the high level, you say any reusable artifact. A lot of people are like, oh, well, it could be this or that. And it's like, yes. But for us, you know, with customers, we pre-seed. I think we have like 370 reusable components that we've built up over the past years that anyone that, you know, starts working with it has it there, because it helps kind of solve that like cold start problem. The catalog of modules and then the features that get created is this kind of two-sided marketplace. And you have to have both in order to see the value of it. So we do have some that are available kind of from the get-go, but where we start to see the increase is when our customers and enterprises start kind of investing in their own catalogs. And we've had some really exciting stuff going on right now on our R&D side about being able to kind of autonomously crawl existing code and identify reusable assets that are there. And so we're on one side kind of driving and creating the requirements or the needs, right, from the product requirements and our tool that does that, and then mining the raw materials on the code side and then matching those in the middle. Yeah.
I assume with some form of guardrails in both directions for people who want to be cautious about their code going elsewhere, but equally not violating any kind of license policies they may have around public code, et cetera, as well.
You've got it. Yeah. I mean, security is a big thing for us. And, you know, how we deploy our systems is always a big thing. I mean, any large company you go to, as soon as you say we need to see your code, the, you know, the SecOps and all of the red flags come up. So we spend time explaining and going through and showing how we manage everything. But yeah, it's all done very, very securely.
And on the subject of ops, it's weird because bizarrely, this whole kind of AI revolution in the past year or so has introduced a whole bunch of new ops. And you are calling what you're doing code ops. Is that basically what we've been describing? Because I can see you've got a sort of few extra steps here as well. I'm sort of looking at this recent partnership announcement you have, the Crowdbotics Code Ops platform. Yeah, is that what we've been describing, or is there a bit more to it as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's it, right? I mean, at a high level, you know, code ops is how you, how do I say it without giving like the marketing description on our website or something, but it is how you kind of, you know, systematically reuse code at scale. And, you know, within that sentence, there's a lot of different facets that have to happen in order to do that, again, as low impact to existing workflows and processes as possible. And it goes beyond just managing the code. It's how do you enable requirements to happen in a way that you can then index and match? How do you actually go through and store the code? How do you identify reusable components? How do you make them searchable? And all of that. So all of that kind of gets blanketed under this notion of reusing code at scale.
And you have these four stages. I see plan, match, assemble, complete. Which is a very optimistic.
Right. Well, I will say that the complete stage is where we, you know, that's our handoff to our partner
GitHub.
You've done
your job, and it's like,
we've done everything we need to do. Now use these tools to let developers go develop.
So how does this look in the process? Is it IDE plugins? Is it like a CI style platform? Is it a drag and drop library, or is it all of the above? Or what do I see as a customer?
Yeah, of course. You know, the thing that we strive for, and so there's two sides generally, right? There's the non-technical, which is where, you know, project managers or anyone with an idea that isn't a dev is trying to get this idea out of their head. So we do have a tool for that. It is a platform called PRD AI, which is this kind of natural language interfacing tool that you can go in and build your product requirements, fine tune them, get suggestions from AI, analyze for security risk, et cetera, et cetera. So this is this kind of platform that people can go in and you can also search through all the modules, again, they're reusable artifacts that you have there. On the developer side, it's actually much less intrusive. You know, again, where we always strive to get is that we want developers and really everyone that uses our platform to kind of be benefactors of it without having to change what they do already. You know, I believe your background's in development and so is mine. And so, and I think everyone that is there knows that changing developers' minds is one of the hardest things in the world to do. And so what we want to do is just be able to just deliver them this value without them having to, you know, learn a new system, without having to install a new IDE, you know, all the way to the point of like, can we do this in some way without any plugins, just something that happens in the background. It's just this magical event that just happens and they go to start a new project and they're already kind of given this wealth of information and starting point that again is non-zero. I mean, the worst thing that I would love to see a future where no developer ever has to go to file new, like ever again, right? It should just already be there. Something should already be there to a degree, whether it's code that was generated by AI or reusable code that we've dropped in there, whether it's actual context of the business requirements that gets preseeded into a Copilot instance. So their code complete is better than what it would be from a net zero starting point. Like, that is where we really want to go. So on the developer side, it is very unobtrusive on how they're able to commit stuff in and then how things just kind of get dumped on their lap for them to start working with.
But how do they get that? Is it, does it like create a Git repository or something?
So after the PRD AI tool has done all of the, you know, the requirements, definition and stuff, we do kick everything out into a GitHub repo. That is all kind of set up and ready to roll. So the developers just log in, clone down the repo, start developing. And then it goes from there.
And I can see a few screenshots. So firstly, I do see this planning aspect. We have the PID AI. I'm having a complete blank on what PID stands for.
Product requirements.
That's what
it is. Yes. PRD, BRD, plan, project scope. There's a lot of names.
I'm going to kind of skip through the match bit because there's not so much to see on the website about how this would look. But look at the assemble part, and I can see you have this sort of catalog. And is this... So I can see on the screenshot here a subscription trial, two-factor authentication module, et cetera, et cetera. Do these then all get customized dynamically with the requirements, or are these still relatively fixed modules?
So these are still relatively fixed, right? And so to, you know, the screen that you're looking at here, so the modules kind of happen in two ways, right? The screen here is really just a like a browsable catalog, right? You could think of it as like your Amazon store for going to look to see what reusable kind of components are out there. The interesting part though is that on the within the PRD or the product requirements doc tool, and I don't know if this shows it on here, but at the bottom of each user stories, it'll actually show which modules match to it.
Okay. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
So as you know, people are creating the requirements, they can actually see what level of code coverage and what might be out there for them to use. And those ones that are shown within the PRD are ones that they can basically say, yes, I want to use this. And then it gets kind of auto deployed and dropped into a GitHub repo. You know, the catalog itself as the Amazon catalog for reusable components, that's kind of there if you're just browsing and maybe something didn't pop up or if some new feature came around the corner that, you know, the project manager pulled you to the side and was like, hey, can you actually implement Facebook for me? And you're like, oh gosh, okay, well maybe. And so you can go kind of browse and search through and pull stuff down.
Okay. And as far as I can tell, it kind of looks like the product owners almost determine what will land in the developer's lap. I mean, how happy are they?
Yeah, I mean, Well, so to a degree, right? Yeah. You know, what we've seen and what I've seen over many years in the development side is that during the kind of requirements and scoping phase, right, you will have a technical architect or some lead dev that is part of that process. And so they do have input, and we've seen customers use it where the, you know, the technical architect will come in and be like, absolutely not, we're not using any of these, and they just kind of blow them all up. And some that are like, you know what, these seem to have good coverage, let's put them in there. And at the end of the day too, right, if they get dropped in the dev's laps and they're like, we actually don't need this, you can just delete them out, which is always a great thing to do. But the, you know, the other interesting kind of piece to this as well that we're really interested in studying more is that as of today, there's this kind of weird thing that happens in software development in that developers can develop and they can also kind of bridge into the non-technical world of project managers and designers and, you know, BAs and SEs, right? But no one can kind of infiltrate into the dev side. Mm. And we think that with AI and where software is going, that's actually going to change in a degree, and we want to help change that, meaning that what are ways that you can make project management more involved in the development process, right? Because that chasm between the two, I think, builds... I think it builds a number of things. I don't, not negative, it builds resentment, builds anger, builds all kinds of stuff. But that kind of chasm there, I think, is a really interesting problem because, you know, it's one where the bridge doesn't go both ways.
Yeah.
And we think that if you are able to kind of extend that, you might actually get a much more fluid software development lifecycle.
Yeah.
Where there is participation throughout it. And we've also kind of explored this idea of, you know, can you have requirements change in real time as code is committed that may differ from what the requirements were. So you get this two-way conversation rather than, you know, an us and them-ish mentality that gets raised up.
Yeah, it tends to
life cycles.
The feedback tends to come back too late most of the time, doesn't it? And
you've got it.
Just, we didn't really, sort of with a lot of these AI tools, you kind of assume everything is the answer, but what languages and technologies do you support? I could see some languages mentioned when it comes to creating your own modules, but in the broader, do you support everything or is it just particular languages?
Yeah. So as of now, so there's two ways. So one, you can drop in any code mm-hmm. of any language and have it be packaged up into a module. You can have that of any code in any language be indexed, be searchable, be matchable against what the requirements are. Where we do have some restrictions today is that we're able to actually generate what we call like scaffolding, mm-hmm. which is like a lot of additional code that goes into support the modules themselves. Mm-hmm. And that right now we only have for React and Django, mm-hmm. but we're getting a lot of customer feedback in that maybe just having the modules themselves without the scaffolding is super beneficial. Mm-hmm. So that kind of point is in development.
Yeah.
In product research on what we'll do. But net is that as of today, you can go in and drop in any language that you want. It can become a module. We've also seen people in a lot of ask around, you know, can we put design assets as modules, right? Like, can we have images?
I was wondering that because like, you kept talking about asset, and I was wondering if you were occasionally referring to things that weren't code as well. But yeah.
So we have it in test right now of being able to have like images. You know, a lot of our enterprise partners, like, I don't know why, you know, each of our delivery centers feels the need to use a different shade color of our logo. Can we please just put the standard one in there and then have that get dropped into every project? So they kind of have this image asset file to go along with everything. But that is on the roadmap and that is coming soon because, again, everyone is asking for that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So even though you've been around for a little while, it does feel like the past sort of year has been a relatively busy one. What's next on your roadmap? And will you use Crowdbotics to create it? No, but what's next on your roadmap?
That's a great question. So I think that there's quite a few things that are coming along the road that we find super, super compelling to think about. One of the first ones is, and really I would say the big one, is this kind of drive towards natural language to code. Yep. And where do we kind of fit in that puzzle? You know, there's a great line by Sam Altman the other day is that, you know, when you're developing around AI, you can basically look at it in two ways. You can believe that the models today are as good as they are going to get mm-hmm. and then kind of build around that. Or you can assume that they are going to get substantially better and kind of design for that.
Yeah.
So we are really interested in continuing to kind of skate where the puck will be and not where it is today. And it is looking to find ways for us to develop and continue to grow our platform to facilitate if a model is able to get to pure natural language to code with some high percentage of accuracy. And then what does that mean? For us, we still do believe that the reuse side is very, very important because, you know, again, computer science and should maybe specify more into like software development is becoming highly, highly commoditized, specifically with AI. And in any market where commoditization happens, you get this kind of explosion in the amount of it that's out there. And for businesses that can be bad at times, meaning that like there's going to be this huge explosion in the amount of code that now enterprises and businesses have to manage and maintain and keep track of and do security and verify around. And that idea of being able to reuse it is one that historically, if you look at other markets and other areas, has been a really, really good place to be and has done a lot of good for the markets that they're in. So for us, we are continuing down this concept and notion of how do we do reuse at scale in a way that is very low impact. So as these models get better, we are still positioned around it.
And feeding into that, I think anyone who's interested, the tendency I found with a lot of these model-based services is that it's not really that possible to have kind of a self-serve option, that scalable part you mentioned. I don't think you have that at the moment, do you? If someone was interested in trying the platform, they have to kind of talk to you.
Well, so there's parts of it, right? Yeah. So the product requirements tool, so being able to go from natural language into requirements, anyone can go do that.
Cool.
We've got a version out where you can sign up, put it in. I think that that version, the public version, like you're limited to like three. So you can create three, test it out, see how things are working. Okay. And then afterwards, someone will want to talk to you. The larger like full buy of the platform is something where, we'd like to chat. I
think that's one of the interesting aspects with this whole new ecosystem is that things work a little differently. You don't just sort of plug stuff in and off you go, unfortunately. It's lowering the barrier in some ways, but increasing it in others. Cool. All right then. Well, Corey, nice to meet someone who's been doing this for a while as opposed to just a new thing. And yeah, thank you very much for joining me.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
And that was my interview with Corey from Crowdbotics. I will be back in the studio for the next 6 weeks. Oh, God, I am exhausted. I can't wait after this episode. So I'm going to save any longer discussions and catch-ups to those episodes where the sound quality is much better. So until next time, thank you for joining me in the Tech Lounge. I have been Christian Schiller. Take care, everybody.
So that was it. That was our guest today. Thank you very much for joining me in the Tech Lounge. I have been Christian Schiller. If you want to know more about Tech Lounge, head on over to christianschiller.com or please tell your friends about us. It's quiet and cozy in here, but the more listeners, the merrier. You can find more at christianschiller.com/podcast or in the show notes or episode notes, wherever you found this podcast. Thank you very much for joining me, and you're most welcome next time.